If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by HelloFresh. Go to HelloFresh.com and use the promo code LAWPOD30 to save $30 off.
Our listeners know that every time we get a HelloFresh box.
Is that why you hit your wife? Withdrawn? Is that why you drink and pop pills? Withdrawn? Are you a virgin? Withdrawn.
Says here you robbed a hospital. Why'd you do that?
Yeah, I'm not guilty.
That's not what the other lawyer said.
Actually, I was going to stay in my office tonight and work on my law blog.
Of course, the blah 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 law blog. Wow, you sir are a mouthful.
The jury is instructed to disregard its own testimony.
Your Honor, the prosecution rests.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 112. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your other host, Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
Doing great. Looking forward to answering some more newsworthy questions. And by that, I mean you, because my bar score of late has me not as confident that I would know as much as you. So I'm going to let you tackle it this week. today, we're going to talk about a new case in the Title VII issue that you've talked about before of whether or not sexual orientation is covered under sex discrimination. So that's really interesting what's going on there. And then the main segment, we're going to talk about Trump's threats to NBC. I can't wait to hear the ins and outs of that. And finally, we've got a great listener question or two on legal ethics and attorney-client privilege. So going to be a fun day. With that said, I guess we'll have to get over to it. Down. 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 All right, breaking down the law. What's this new case and what are the implications for sexual orientation being counted under sex discrimination?
Yeah, I think this is really an incredibly interesting development. So the case is Evans versus Georgia Regional Hospital. It's coming out of the 11th Circuit, and the petitioners have just filed for cert with the Supreme Court. Supreme Court has not yet ruled on that. So first, this is precisely the same kind of case as Hively versus Ivy Tech, which we talked about in episode 60, and Zarda versus Altitude Express, which we talked about in episode 91. Zarda is pending before the Second Circuit en banc. Hively, as all of our listeners know, and if you don't, you should go back and listen to that episode, was an 8-3 opinion by the Seventh Circuit that really kind of opened the floodgates for this issue. We called it out as historic and landmark at the time, and you know that's one on our good prediction side. How about that? I don't want to get overly engage in back.
Andrew was right, everybody. He wants to,
yeah.
He wants
Andrew to, okay. Was right on one thing. Get ready for the next half hour. Andrew was wrong segment next week, but I think I was right on that one. That seeing that this was really going to be a massive decision. I don't deserve a lot of credit because a lot of other legal scholars came to the same conclusion. Anyway,
yeah, but
so
they don't have our
same
podcast,
case.
So.
Well, that's true.
So you win.
Same kind of case, which is employer terminates employee, files a motion to dismiss on which we assume the facts are true, right? All of these employers, including in Hively, you know, reserve the right to.
Oh, I see. This is the one where they first argue like, well, we'll grant that it's all true hypothetically and argue that. And then later, if they happen to lose, they can go back and say, well, no, that's not true.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So that's what you do on a motion to dismiss. You assume that the facts are true. So we do not want to say that any of these employers factually terminated the employee for being gay. But what they have asserted in court is we have the right to terminate you just because you're gay. And the Trump administration, as we covered in episode 91, has directed its Department of Justice to file an amicus brief in the Zarda case that says, yep. And that case famously, and I think it will become infamously, you know, use the analogy of it's perfectly okay for an employer to hang a sign that says no homosexuals need apply. Obviously, for a lot of reasons, I think that position is not going to withstand much scrutiny in the course of history. But there you have it. Evans came out the other way at trial, which is to say trial court granted the motion to dismiss, and that was affirmed by the 11th Circuit. So now you have a case going the opposite direction, and the counsel for Evans, the employee, is Lambda Legal Organization, which is the same counsel in Zarda. And so they filed a cert petition to the Supreme Court. And that cert petition makes a bunch of different arguments, but the key argument that it makes is, and this is a really, really good reason to petition for certiorari to the Supreme Court, is there's now a split among the circuits, right? The Seventh Circuit has said, yes, Title VII does cover sexual orientation as part of its prohibition on discrimination on the basis of sex. The 11th Circuit has now said Title VII does not cover sexual orientation as a part of its ban on the prohibition of discrimination on the basis of sex. So rather than have differing, inconsistent interpretations of federal law based on different states, right? So right now, if you're an employee in Illinois, the law is that Title VII does protect you on the basis of sexual orientation. But if you're an employee in Alabama, which is, you know, just you can drive a couple hundred miles from the southern tip of Illinois to the northern tip of Alabama, and all of a sudden the law, the same federal law, is interpreted exactly the opposite, right?
Sounds like a case for the Supreme Court is what you're saying.
Exactly. And so that's a textbook area where you say, We want the Supreme Court to rule with finality, right? Like we should have, if it's a federal law, it applies in all 50 states. It should apply the same way in all 50 states. And, you know, you then are also argue that the case is significant, right? Like if you had a very, very insignificant federal law that was being interpreted differently across the circuits, that wouldn't make for a very strong cert petition. But I think this is going to be granted. What I find really interesting and potentially dispositive or at least influential going forward is yesterday an amicus brief was filed on behalf of 76 employers arguing in favor of granting cert and in favor of the position taken by Hively and taken in the Lambda Legal cert petition, which is to say that the Supreme Court should not only take the case, but that in taking the case, they should rule that Title VII protects employees on the basis of sexual orientation as part of its prohibition on the basis of sex. And this is really a classic cert petition. I'm going to link it in the show notes. It gives the perspective of the business community, and it isn't an argument about the law. It's an argument about what the effect on businesses will be. So I'm going to cut to sort of the conclusion and then work backwards. The conclusion, this is on page 18 of the petition, is we, the amici, are committed to equal treatment and equal opportunity regardless of sexual orientation, but amici cannot create widespread equality in the workplace by themselves. Title VII plays a crucial role in creating and cultivating workplaces that embody equality by affirming the civil right to be free from discrimination. Okay. So that's the position that these businesses have taken. And it kind of answers the, you know, libertarian argument of, well, you know, if one company wants to protect homosexuals in the workplace, then they're free to do so. But if another company doesn't, then they won't. And, you know, they'll compete and the best business will win out. And this brief, you know, speaks to that argument. And I'm going to get to the arguments they make, which I think are really, really interesting. But first, I think it's really neat to look at who these 76 employers are, right? Because some of them are the usual suspects, right? Companies that we know typically support lefty causes, right? So you have Apple and Ben and Jerry's and Google and eBay and Facebook and the National Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce. Right? That's not too surprising. Then you also have almost all of the large new tech, you know, information economy type companies that are on there, right? So Airbnb, Lyft, and Uber, right? This is probably the only time that those two companies are ever going to be on the same side of any legal matter. Spotify, DoorDash, Dropbox, Pinterest, Indiegogo, all of these kind of new tech companies. But then, I mean, I've named like 15, right? The bulk of the brief are Fortune 500 powerhouse companies, right? Citrix and Intel, CBS and Viacom, Cigna Life Insurance, Sun Life, Mass Mutual. You have, in addition to those insurance companies, those international, multinational, mega conglomerate insurance companies, you also have the largest banks and investment firms, right? MasterCard, Morgan Stanley, Deutsche Bank, RBC Bank. There's Diageo, which is the largest alcohol manufacturer in the world. American Airlines, Levi Strauss, right? So these are not companies that are typically, right? I am positive Morgan Stanley is not giving money to the Elizabeth Warren for 2020 presidential campaign, right? These are very, very staid, conservative by temperament, if not by political ideology companies. Right. Also joined by the Miami Heat and the Tampa Bay Rays. I gave the I'm a Rays fan, as you know, so I like seeing that.
That's interesting.
But yeah, so this is not just the Ben and Jerry's and Apple brief, right? This is a ton of mainstream companies that have signed on to say we think Title VII should apply across the United States to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation.
I'm curious how strong that's, you said it was 76. It's funny, at first I thought you meant the business 76, like the gas line.
Are there still 76?
Yeah, but I wonder how much of an impact does that typically make, do you think? Because I don't know, how many total employers are there in the country? There's got to be hundreds of thousands, right? If not more.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we count as that, right?
Oh, yeah, okay. So, if you're counting every single entity, there's got to be millions. So, yeah, how much of an impact does 70? And I'm just curious, like, what's the difference between, you know, 50 or 62 when you get one of these briefs? Like, how much of an impact does that number make, I wonder?
Yeah, I don't mean to overly emphasize the number. I think what's much more interesting here is the diversity and range of business, and in particular, the weight of the, you know, high-end companies that are on this, right? And so it runs the whole gamut from, you know, sort of relatively small, a couple relatively small companies, all the way up to, you know, Intel, Viacom, right? I mean, these are, you know, mega conglomerates that are, you know, multi-billion dollar enterprises that are weighing in. And what I think is significant is whenever in a commercial case, you have a pro-business argument being made in a spot where it's counterintuitive. So let me give you an analogy. One of the things that your state started to pioneer about 10 years ago, the California Supreme Court essentially invalidated all non-compete clauses, right? And I think I've talked about this.
Because of tech companies mainly?
Because of tech companies, right? Yeah. Because the way in which you start up a new tech company is by having a very mobile workforce. And so you go to somebody who's a middle manager at Google that you think is really smart, and you offer them a bunch of stock options in the startup, and they have to be free to say, yep, I'm quitting my good old 9-to-5 job at Google to go with this great new tech startup. That's how we get innovation. That mobility was kind of the key. And California, for all of, you know, the Republicans pointing about, you know, high taxation or whatever, you know, too much regulation. And I think in the, you know, American Enterprise, when we poked at their freedom study, right, California was like the 49th most free state, right? If California and Maryland were right at the bottom. Notwithstanding that sort of mischaracterization, you can't really argue that California isn't the preeminent venue in the country for tech startups, right? And so all of a sudden you had economists analyzing the impact of striking down non-compete clauses. And it challenged kind of the basic narrative, right? Like the narrative that's been in effect in this country since its inception is it's pro-employer to enforce terms in a contract. Right. And all of a sudden you had economists, right? Like, you know, California is California, but all of a sudden you had economists in, you know, outside of California, even conservative economists writing that overall for the business economy, it's better to have restrictions to tailor them narrowly or to do away with radically restrictive covenants not to compete. That's better for the economy as a whole, and it's better for the pro-business environment as a whole. And then that analysis, in my view, really trickled through and started permeating, and you got cases in red and sometimes deep red states, in Missouri, in South Dakota, that curtailed covenants not to compete. That I don't think those states, because, you know, we talk about legal realism. State Supreme Courts in particular are cognizant of the political and economic impact that they're going to have. Hmm. Right. And there is no doubt in my
but
mind.
But I don't know that that will apply here. I mean, I see what you're saying, but like,
yeah,
this seems like a whole different thing where you've got a Gorsuch to go against. You've got you've got a Gorsuch to contend with, and an Alito.
You do. There is no chance that this case is going to pick up, you know, Gorsuch, Thomas, or Alito. There's a very, very small chance that it's going to pick up Roberts. It's kind of got Anthony Kennedy square in its sights, right?
Yeah.
And that's and as we've talked about, Anthony Kennedy has a really good record.
Yeah, it must be weird to be Anthony Kennedy and find himself in this. He's always in this position. It's just because if you're slightly more reasonable, I guess, than or something, you know, it's kind of funny that he's the focus of every Supreme Court case now.
And let me say, and this is total I don't know Anthony Kennedy. I don't know any of his clerks. I know some Supreme Court clerks, but I don't know anybody who clerked for Kennedy. So this is total speculation and dismiss it as such. I don't think Anthony Kennedy likes being Anthony Kennedy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things we talked about in the halcyon days of OA back when we didn't anticipate this electoral outcome was his sort of drift leftward in the Supreme Court's 2016 term. And I really think he was sort of preparing for life as part of the Supreme Court's new, you know, six liberal justice majority under President Clinton with Justice Merrick Garland or somebody else on the, I have nothing to go, I mean, I want to stress how much speculation is going into this, but it's sort of how I make sense of his public statements and what I've seen in, you know, reading almost every case that comes out of the Supreme Court. I kind of detect that reluctance of, you know, I don't think he likes being the guy who shapes what law means in this country.
But it's so funny how you sort of stumble into that. It's like accidental. Yeah. And then you're the whole focus of every case, but, yeah. But back to this case, I guess, so you're saying there isn't exactly like a new or innovative legal argument yet in this case. It's more the fact that there's an amicus brief that has so many companies signed onto it, so many employers of different backgrounds, but they're not making like a new legal argument.
They are not. Look, the best legal argument
was
you
already
can
made.
Make was it? Is the argument made in Hively. Right. And that, you know, we went through that decision. Yeah. That's what the briefs will say, you know, what Lambda's opening petitioner's brief is going to say if and when cert is granted. But this, like I said, I think this has some potential to sort of influence in the background. So here are the arguments that are made in the brief. And Some of them might surprise you. Some of them might not. But the thrust of the brief is it's pro-business to rule in favor of extending Title VII to cover sexual orientation uniformly across the U.S. And the first set of arguments are the ones that you might anticipate. They are the benefits of diversity in the workplace, and they talk about the actual statistics that LGBTQ individuals have faced in terms of employment discrimination across the country. There are two points here that are sort of the opposite sides of a coin that were made that I thought were fairly interesting. The first is when you have... when you don't have uniform anti-discrimination laws, then LGBTQ people who are at an employer that doesn't specifically protect on the basis of sexual orientation tend to want to leave, right? And so they waste time, like not just they're unhappy in the workplace, but they're actively looking, right? They might take a job, but they're actively looking to find another job that's going to protect them, that's going to give them more security. That makes a lot of sense, right? And so instead of having a fully engaged and productive employee, you have an employee who's sort of doing the bare minimum and is circulating their resumes until they can get to somewhere where they're going to be protected. And the flip side of that is employees who are, and this I thought was really, really interesting, that LGBTQ employees who are working a job presently with an employer that protects them on the basis of sexual orientation, right? Because any employer, I should say this as a sidebar, any employer can say as part of their company policies, hey, we won't fire you on the basis of your sexual orientation, right? Like, They're
now,
free
but
to
legally,
do
are they held to their own policy? Like, could they, you know, I know it's a company policy, but if for some reason they did fire them, can the employer or can the employee then sue, or is it like
yes,
okay,
if it's made if your job offer and the letter says, hey, we'd like to extend you a job offer, it will be subject to the terms and conditions as set forth in our employee handbook, and most job letters do come in that form because the employer wants to be able to say, hey, look, you know, we have your affirmative assent to things like, you know, whatever conditions they want to put on the workplace. So if it incorporates those terms by reference and then the employer violates those terms, you can absolutely sue them for breach of contract. Yeah. So now, you know, is an individual likely to sue CBS for that? You know, but when you get to the level of a CBS or a Viacom or a Diageo, you know, these global multinational corporations, they have robust human resources departments too, right? So you know what I mean? You have infrastructure within the company itself to reinforce that policy as well. So, you know, answer to the question is number one, yes, you can sue. And number two, in most cases, you don't have to, because the fact that the company has, you know, publicly put that in means that they've also staffed up their departments, usually with people that are charged with enforcing the policy as written in the handbook. And so you have this, you know, bureaucratic layer that is actually working on your side.
Right.
Okay. So the other part of the diversity argument that I thought was super neat was people who are working at a company that has policies that protect on the basis of sexual orientation tend to stay in those jobs, even if they're not happy with the job. Right. And so even when you're being underutilized, in other words, the all of this is documented.
Oh, so the other argument is like it's better to have an environment, a business environment where employees that are not happy or not being utilized are free to go, kind of. But this makes it so an employee might be stuck in their job.
Yeah. That again, you have the workplace mobility argument. And think about that in practical terms, which is, take somebody who's gay, who is currently being employed in a strictly administrative capacity, right? But this person has, you know, the potential to be, you know, to work independently, to be a supervisor, to move up. Well, that person might stay at a CBS doing administrative work as opposed to move on to a company that is in a jurisdiction that doesn't have protections, and the company doesn't have protections to take a job for which they would have, you know, higher skills, make higher pay, and, you know, contribute more to the economy. So I thought that was a really interesting. So that's the diversity argument. You expect that one. The second argument they made is an argument in favor of uniformity. And here, you know, one of the things I always love is going back and, you know, using the administration's own arguments against it. And this is pages 13 to 14 of the brief. They say, the need for uniformity is underlined by the conflicting positions adopted by the EEOC and the Department of Justice. And we talked about that episode 91 with Zarda, right? Like, you've got two different branches of the Trump administration arguing for two different interpretations, right? Like, how much... you cannot get more uncertain than that. And then the argument is that businesses have to spend resources trying to predict the outcome of a particular court when the rules aren't clear. And then courts have to expend resources adjudicating those cases. And all of those things have real costs, and those costs get passed on to the consumer. And we've talked about this before, but, you know, I think I was answering a question in a Q&A about, like, what's the biggest thing I learned that I didn't understand in law school? And that was that a business, you know, and the bulk of my clients are small businesses now, but I've represented, you know, businesses of all sizes in my career, including, you know, Microsoft and ExxonMobil. Uniformly, from small business to large business, if you ask the CEO, would you rather have a clear law that says you can't do this, or would you rather have an unclear law that says maybe you can, maybe you can't? They would all prefer the former, right?
Yeah.
Because when the law is maybe you can, maybe you can't, then you've got to pay somebody like me to render an opinion. My opinion isn't dispositive. We have to write something, but I can't promise you it's going to protect you. Yeah, I mean, you know, it adds up all these costs, and businesses would much rather be like, if I'm thinking again, go back to the California non-compete example, right? The businesses say, okay, right, I get it. Okay, can't prevent people from
and they're
going.
Not worried about their competitor doing it, really, because it's illegal. Yep. Versus if it's unclear, they're like, oh, do I need to do this to have some sort of competitive edge or something?
Yep, exactly right. So that's argument two, is the uniformity argument, which I think is a good one. And then argument three is argument based on inefficiencies in the job market. This is pages 16 to 18. I'm going to read a little bit because I think it's interesting. So the brief says, an interpretation of Title VII that excludes sexual orientation as a form of sex discrimination makes it more difficult and expensive for those doing business in jurisdictions without other laws against sexual orientation discrimination, right? That is the 28 states that don't have protections. And I've been saying it was 30. There are two new states that have signed on. So 22 states and the District of Columbia protect on the basis of sexual orientation, but 28 states don't, right? So more expensive for those doing business in those 28 states to recruit LGBT employees. And then they get specific. They say, our LGBT employees and employees who prefer to work in a community that does not tolerate discrimination are less willing to transfer to locations where such discrimination is permitted, right? Undermining businesses' ability to organize a workforce without regard for such arbitrary legal barriers. In this way, excluding sexual orientation from Title VII's sex discrimination protections undermines business efforts to recruit, organize, and retain talent. And that's another thing. That's an interesting feature of these multi-state and multinational conglomerations. Like, when you are hired by Viacom, you know, and they say, hey, look, Thomas, we think you're doing a fantastic job. We would like to, you know, have you manage the Atlanta office. And you say, you know, dude, like, I don't want to go from California to Atlanta. Yeah. And they say, well, how about we double your salary and pay your relocation expenses? And it's a bump up. And eventually, you know, there's a level at which you're like, okay, I'm going to Atlanta. This argument is businesses are hampered in their ability to do that, in their ability to freely contract with their employees, right? Like, this is the core of the pro-business conservative libertarian message, right? We have this artificial barrier that prevents us from doing so when the target jurisdiction is a place that is that doesn't have protections for LGBTQ employees. And, you know, as soon as you take it out of the, you know, Thomas to Atlanta, as soon as you start thinking about real people, right, this is a no-brainer, right? Like, you know, any of our friends in the LGBTQ community, you know, you could just imagine their employer saying, well, we'd like to, you know, relocate you to Alabama. That there's no, you know, there's no level of...
One could argue it would be more based on the culture there that's not going to change because of this law versus... Right. The fact that another employer in that state might, if they want to leave their job, might discriminate against them. But still,
you could. But, you know, I would give my counter argument to that is, I mean, you know, I just took two trips out to Austin, Texas and Salt Lake City, Utah, which are deep blue cities in the middle of deep red states. Mm-hmm. Right. And lots of people. I mean, it was the thing I heard over and over again was, yeah, hey, like I love being in Austin. I love being in Salt Lake City, you know, and so I think there is, you know, some ability to, you know, right. You can't change the entire culture of Utah.
Yeah.
But you can change the culture of Salt Lake City, right? You can change the culture of Austin. So, you know, it is a fair point. It is a good point to kind of rein in the extent of the argument, but I think it still has sort of interesting force. So, you know, I put all that together, you know, yeah, it is, you are going to get an originalist interpretation from, you know, the activist conservative wing of this court. But I think this has the potential to have some legs in terms of how this issue is discussed.
So I guess prediction time, two-part prediction. Do you think they'll grant cert? And then what will the result be if they do, I guess? So let's pin you down to
two-part prediction. Tee up the Andrew was wrong music.
Yeah, right? Get it. Warm it up. Yeah, get it. Get, yeah.
Yep. I am going to predict that the Supreme Court grants cert in this case, and so long as the lineup of the court does not change between granting cert and the issuance of an opinion, I am going to predict that it narrowly comes out 5-4.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. My trick is going to be, yeah, I'll be 5-4. I just won't even say which direction, but it'll be 5-4. I think that's a safe.
But I'm going to say 5-4 reversing the 11th Circuit. And I don't know. The one area where I'm going to double down on this, because the one thing that I predicted coming out of Hively that has not yet happened, that I'm kind of doing my best to make happen with whatever limited influence I have, is I think the Flaumen Ripple concurrence, you've heard me say this a bunch of times, right? It's a very, very narrow ground for concurring, and it extends the protections of Title VII on the basis of sexual orientation without, you know, sort of you having to buy into, you know, what might be characterized as kind of the larger, you know, civil rights, you know, social justice agenda. I could very easily see an Anthony Kennedy signing on to the Flaumen Ripple concurrence, and those judges are, to the best of my knowledge, Republican appointees, right? They are moderate conservative justices, and I can see, so I'm going to add that on just to ensure that I get this wrong. I'm going to add that into my 5-4 prediction. I think you're going to see the Supreme Court embrace some form of the Flaumen Ripple concurrence from Hively and overrule the 11th Circuit. I want, you know, we have so much pessimism on this show, and yeah, I want to have right. I want to be optimistic.
I like it. Andrew is sacrificing his ability to be correct for the sake of optimism. No, hopefully you're right. All right. Yep. Thanks for taking us through that. All right, Andrew. Well, Trump is at it again. He has threatened NBC, and he sort of threatened to take away their license, which is, oh my gosh, taking away NBC's license. That's NBC goes back, gosh, how long does it go back? It's got to be, what, 70, 80 years or something? I mean, it goes back forever. Like, it's really old, right?
Well, right. They are the national broadcast.
I mean, yeah, like, the idea that the minute they do something, our a-hole president doesn't like, he's just going to get rid of them. It's unbelievable the hubris involved. But anyway, what's going on? Can he do that? Is what he said any sort of violation of anything we hope he violates and can impeach him for, or what? Break it down for us.
Yeah. Well, so look, let's start with the two things that make this ominous, which are relatively straightforward. But number one, this was specifically directed to the Federal Communications Commission to revoke NBC's license in connection with NBC breaking a story. That story in turn said that had two pieces of information in it. Number one, that apparently Donald Trump requested a tenfold increase in the nation's nuclear stockpile. And number two, that the Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called Donald Trump a moron for doing so. I think we've always said that we've never questioned Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's intelligence.
Yeah,
we may have questioned his loyalty, but that would certainly be, if the predicate were true, then the conclusion would definitely follow. so that was the context. The first ominous thing about it is the FCC is an executive agency. Donald Trump has appointed the chair of the FCC. And so when the president threatens to use agencies that are within his control to retaliate against private citizens and organizations, that's incredibly disturbing, even if it's not a crime. And I don't think this is a specific crime here. I should cut to the chase on that. And number two, obviously, this continues the pattern of this administration's attack on the press. And I don't think we need to belabor the point on.
Yeah.
But what makes this interesting is NBC is not licensed by the Federal Communications Commission.
Interesting.
The FCC doesn't regulate NBC at all. And in fact, if you go to the FCC's own website, I will link this in the show notes, of course, and click on media/radio/public and broadcasting /regulation, in italics, it says, we, the FCC, license only individual broadcast stations. We do not license TV or radio networks such as CBS, NBC, ABC, or Fox, or other organizations with which stations have relationships such as PBS or NPR.
Oh, I never
except
thought
to the extent that those entities may also be station licensees. We also do not regulate information provided over the internet.
I see. So it's the individual channels, like Channel 3 or something,
correct,
is what they are, yep, licensing, and then those channels, depending on where you live, they have a relationship with NBC, and they're okay. I see.
Yeah, and so that's how the FCC's regulatory powers work. The applicable regulations are 47 CFR Chapter 1. Subchapter B covers common carriers. We discussed that in our two-parter on net neutrality. Subchapter C covers broadcast radio services. That's Part 70 at SEC. And so the FCC's regulatory powers for broadcast, right? And it's entitled broadcast radio services because these are archaic, but they cover television as well. But the critical aspect is it must be over-the-air broadcasting that are transmitting whatever they're transmitting, be it a radio or a TV program, over the publicly owned spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. So think about, it's easiest to think about this in the context of, tuning, because we actually still have radio tuners in our car, even though we don't have dials anymore. But, tuning the radio in your car, you go from frequency to frequency. That's a public spectrum. And the idea at
it's like a shared space. It's like a...
Exactly right. Okay. It's a common resource. And so the FCC, when it's a common exhaustible resource, right, only one radio station in any geographical area could broadcast on the, 1000 hertz spectrum, for example.
Right.
So the idea is common resource limited. So the FCC gets jurisdiction over that and can allocate that scarce resource and regulate it appropriately rather than just kind of have a free market, first come, first
serve. Yeah, it would be chaos if it was just competing radio stations and whoever had the stronger tower would,
that's right. Like literally, that would be your business strategy would be, let's build a bigger
tower
and drown this guy out. Yeah. So that's the justification. And TV, your local TV stations still broadcast over the air. I know, particularly for our audience, where we have some demographic data, and I think 2/3 of our audience is 35 and younger.
Nice.
You may not recall the days of TV antennas, but you can actually still hook a TV up to an antenna and pick up over the air.
Wait, hold on. A separate question. We shouldn't branch off on this, but I thought they were going to get rid of that, like, I don't know, 5 years ago. Remember? And then the whole world threw a fit and blamed Obama. Do you remember that?
I remember that, but I don't remember.
Topic for another show. But anyway, yeah, for now, you can still use the rabbit ears, I guess.
Right. Yeah, you can still use the rabbit ears. These TV stations are still broadcasting over the limited public spectrum. And so the individual stations are then subject to FCC regulation, and they can be decertified on the basis of content. And I should add that some... beginning in the Reagan administration, because of course the antitrust rules that prohibited broadcasters from owning TV stations were relaxed, that there were a number of interlocking rules related to vertical integration that were just completely abandoned in the
Makes
Reagan
sense.
Administration and thereafter. So there are networks that own stations. And I believe NBC owns a couple of TV stations. I know that Viacom, which is the parent company of CBS, discussed in the A segment, Viacom owns some TV stations. So there is some integration. So you could, target a couple of NBC stations with your FCC, but you couldn't target NBC, thankfully.
Yeah.
Right. And look, this is an example of where eventually, right, this law is going to change, because you do not have the current state of regulation is any channel that is conveyed over cable, right,
yeah,
is not subject to FCC regulation at all. Right. And so I always thought growing up, on cable, you would have your local channels, right? Those are subject to FCC regulation, mm-hmm, even though they're being conveyed by cable, because the source is a broadcast source. Then you had cable only channels, right? Like MTV, that could offer a little more content than, a little more risque or adult content,
yeah,
than NBC. But, you never saw nudity on MTV, except occasionally in the background of a couple videos, right? You didn't have F-bombs, right? Like it seemed like they were sort of in this middle ground. And then, there was HBO and Showtime, the premium channels, and they had, nudity and no restrictions attached to them. Turns out that all of that is marketing. There's nothing to prohibit, say, a cable only channel from having whatever content they want on that cable only channel. It is entirely voluntary restrictions and branding.
But it's for the main network, because they're still simultaneously broadcasting, they kind of do both, right? Do they broadcast it through the air and through cable? So
yes,
because of that, those are still regulated. But if you're just cable, you can kind of do whatever you want.
Yep, exactly right. And so the FCC has applied that same rule of you can do whatever you want from cable to satellite, right? Which makes sense, right? Same thing.
Yeah.
It's a private, relationship.
Like, yeah, people are... Okay. Because the company, presumably the company, it's like a private satellite. It's not a government satellite that they're relaying the signal off of or something.
Right.
So, okay.
Right. And that's exactly the justification, right? The justification is basically you have voluntarily welcomed cable or, mm-hmm, satellite TV into your house, but you can't get rid of over-the-air TV. I'm not sure how well that rationale stacks up. But the interesting technological thing is portions of the satellite relay are, in fact, over the public spectrum.
Right?
So from space, it's a private satellite. It is being relayed to a private transmitter and then privately distributed to your house. But a portion of that transmission does in fact go over the public spectrum. So you have this weird situation where, you've got an archaic rule that is being inconsistently applied. And in the long run, I think, eventually you're going to have a uniform rule, right? And I hope, I think it's moving in this direction that it will be, you know, moving into the lack of regulation direction, because, you know, the FCC has no and will never have jurisdiction over cable or the internet. And they've rightly sort of determined that, you know, DirecTV, that satellite TV looks like cable and the internet, even though technologically they would have an argument for it. So that's I don't know if I want to make a formal, well, we could do an Andrew was wrong prediction because, you know, I'm talking about something that's going to happen 20 years from now. And OA is still going 20 years from now.
There'll still be like one or two listeners that will hold us to it. You know, there will be. They'll mark it.
I wouldn't want anything less.
Carve it in a tree or something. yeah. Okay. So once again, absolute assholeness meets incompetence is what you're saying. So not only is he being a jerk, he's clueless yet again, and there's no NBC broadcast license for the FCC. So
there you go.
All right. Well, that's all.
No, wait, that's the wrong segment.
Oh, man. All right. Thanks for breaking that down. Andrew, today's episode is brought to us by HelloFresh. This is one of our favorite sponsors. We both love HelloFresh. HelloFresh is the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking more fun so you can focus on the whole experience and not just the final plate.
Yeah, our listeners know that every time we get a HelloFresh box, my son and I do like an Iron Chef style cook-off in the kitchen. In a single, you know, not particularly large kitchen, we're able to spread out all the ingredients. My son is 14 and he makes the meal from start to finish with no help or assistance from me. I mean, in fact, we're kind of competitive. Likes to see who gets done first. And it's a lot of fun.
Hoard
so
all
yeah.
the utensils and stuff, hoard all the knives and the, no, yeah. I'm using this.
It's not quite the like level of cutthroat you see on TV. You know, I will share utensils, and cooking instruments with him.
But love how they give you the freshest ingredients exactly in the quantities that you need. That is my favorite part. I'm a little bit OC, and I just love not having to waste any food. That is one of my biggest pet peeves, is having to throw away food that we couldn't quite get to.
Yeah.
So I love that it just has exactly what you need.
I really like the fact that the meals are reviewed. HelloFresh has two full-time registered dietitians on staff. And that, you know, look, it might sound like a buzzword. The meals are healthy. They're properly portioned. They are, a lot of folks know that I've been dieting recently, and it's when you eat good, fresh food, you don't need an 1800 calorie meal to feel satisfied and feel full. And so that's really helped me as I'm trying to lose weight.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. The portions are great because you feel full after you're done. Yeah. And you haven't eaten a bunch of unhealthy crap, essentially. HelloFresh delivers to your doorstep in a recyclable insulated box for free, and they are less than $10 a meal.
Yeah.
So you definitely should check it out. Go to HelloFresh.com. Make sure to use that promo code LAWPOD30. That'll get you $30 off your first week when you subscribe. Again, HelloFresh.com, promo code LAWPOD30.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
Okay, some awesome listener questions here. Let's go with John Funk. I used to be a crime and courts journalist. Oh, cool. And as such, I got to know a lot of the local trial lawyers. One of them seemed to just spontaneously decide that he was my lawyer. I love this question. He once explicitly told me, anything you say to me is protected under attorney-client privilege. And twice he told me, as your lawyer, I would advise you to... I never requested his services, he never billed me, and I never paid him. I didn't go to him for advice on the two above-mentioned incidents. He just knew about them because we were Facebook friends, and I'd posted about them. So my question is, was he officially my lawyer in any legally binding sense? He seemed to think so, but I certainly never did. That is awesome. I will say, maybe he's just a big Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas fan. Because that's something that one of the characters always says, as your attorney advised you to. So maybe it was just that.
Right, right. I love. So we opened up a patron thread for submitting questions, and we're going to take a bunch of them. This is one of the more upvoted ones. I think for good reason. This is a great question.
Awesome.
And so the answer is, I think as you suspect, no, he was never your lawyer. The client has an absolute right to consent to the representation and to consent to the scope of the representation.
So there's right? no like magic say, words provision in the law where like if he gets away with it three times, then all of a sudden.
and the other thing is the thing that is the most astonishing to me that a lawyer would say this to you, John, is the notion of anything you say to me is protected under attorney-client privilege. We know that, like, that's not true.
Oh, yeah. Right? Even like, if he is your lawyer, he's his lawyer.
Right.
Saying,
real good example. I am your lawyer, Thomas. But tomorrow you tell me, like, hey, I'm planning on knocking off a series of 7-Elevens. Not only is that something I can disclose, but it's something I'm mandatorily required to disclose.
It's almost like the plot for The Firm is not entirely factually sound. Sort of like that.
Boy, do I have a newfound appreciation for The Firm now that we're 11. I honestly, I have been saying this for years, that The Firm is the worst legal movie ever made.
Oh, how wrong you were.
Man, it is. It's like the third best, apparently.
Yeah, ever.
It's still terrible. So digression over. Remember that, you know, particularly when it comes to written communications, you know, look, courts are very, very loath to put a lawyer on the stand to testify against his client. But one of the things that happens all the time in businesses is, you know, the company will be, you know, discussing something and they'll CC their general counsel, right? Or their outside counsel, right? And there is this kind of notion of, oh, well, if it's got my lawyer's name on it, nobody will ever see this document. It's shielded from discovery by attorney-client privilege. Not true. Mm. What the privilege protects is the seeking and the rendering of legal advice. Right. And so if you're just chatting, if you're just copying your lawyer, or if you're seeking business or other non-legal advice from the lawyer, I mean, my clients seek business advice from me all the time. It's a large part of the value that I bring to small businesses is, you know, I've got that kind of experience. But that sort of stuff is discoverable. Right. It what's not discoverable is, you know, when Eli asks me, hey, can I craft this particular joke in this particular way, or is that libel? Right. And then I render an opinion. That's attorney client privilege. Mm. And that's what we look, you know, again, you know, we've talked about an extended analogy with the, you know, president consulting with his advisors on, you know, should I bomb North Korea, and you want, you know, candid advice. That's a specific analysis of the general case, which is we want, as a general rule, we want people to be able to talk to their lawyers, but we want them to be able to talk to their lawyers for the purpose of seeking candid legal advice, right? Not just we want to create this loophole whereby, you know, everything that says P. Andrew Torres on it is now forever shielded from discovery. So that's a classic misimpression, and I'm kind of shocked to see a lawyer saying that. So, so great question.
It was like me just deciding. I don't know, some celebrity is my girlfriend or something. I like that. Just all of a sudden, I decide that. Awesome. And then we got another question from Secular Ewok, which I think is a little bit related. What is the appropriate action for a criminal defense lawyer whose client does tell them, "I did it"?
I love the idea of Secular Ewok. I don't think in Star Wars we really learn like what the
Learn about their
religious beliefs of mainstream Ewoks are.
They seem to have a lot of ceremonies going on, there definitely was some religion there.
I want to go back and like digitally edit Return of the Jedi to have like one Ewok taking a knee in the middle of that like circular dancing. You know?
Yeah.
There's our Secular Ewok. Answering the question, Secular Ewok is referencing by implication, you know, the rule that I have passed on from Alan Dershowitz way back in first year criminal law, which was If you're a criminal defense attorney, never ask your client if they did it or not. And the reason is you are prohibited from suborning perjury. So if they say, yes, I did do it, then you can't put on your client as a witness and ask them the question. And you can't put on any other witness that is saying something that you now know to be false. So it really hamstrings you as an attorney. But what can you do? The answer here is driven by Rule 1.2 of the Model Rules of Professional Conduct, which I'll link in the show notes, which subsection D says, a lawyer shall not counsel a client to engage or assist a client in conduct that the lawyer knows is criminal or fraudulent. But a lawyer may discuss the legal consequences of any proposed course of conduct with a client and may counsel or assist a client to make a good faith effort to determine the validity, scope, meaning, or application of the law. So you can really do two things, right? If a client says, I did it. Number one, you can pick apart the prosecution's case to the best of your ability, right? You can suggest by implication anything the prosecution, you know, anything that the jury wants to take away, you are perfectly within the rights of doing your best to impeach the credibility of all of the prosecution's witnesses. You can craft a narrative that says this is not reliable. There is reasonable doubt. Anything could have happened. Right. You can do all of that.
How do you sleep at night? How do you do that?
Well, the way in which you sleep at night is by knowing that the
You're making a bunch of money? No.
No. I find this, I'm glad you asked that as a follow-up question, because, you know, one of the things that's never at, right, like that question of your criminal defense lawyer, your client has told you he's guilty, and yet you go in and defend him anyway. You know, how do you sleep at night? No one ever asks the question in the opposite way, which is you're a prosecutor and you have had meetings with defense counsel where the defendant is in there and cries and in tears as sincerely as any human has ever had, looks at you and says, I didn't do this. You have to drop the case against me. And, you know, no one ever asks, you know, prosecutors, how do you sleep at night knowing that that person might be innocent and you're going to go into court and argue for them.
Okay, well, let's assume I go ask a prosecutor that. Now can you answer the question,
right,
Mr. Torres? Well,
so the answer is on both sides, we have an adversarial system, right? And the other side is not engaged in an independent fact-finding mission to try and discover the truth. The other side is engaged in a one-sided presentation of the strongest case they can make in to promote their side. And the only way in which the system works is if both parties are using in good faith and to the best of their ability their skills in on favor of their side. If you don't want that kind of a system, then, you know, we got to get an entirely different.
You're really dodging the whole thing. It's not as though the two options are try to get the guilty guy off or abandon our entire legal system. Like, isn't there an option of like, well, hey, I don't want to do this. Yeah, I resign.
Look, from a practical perspective, let me give you an example, and I will try and it's a public record, so I guess you could find it. It's one of the few criminal cases that I assisted on right before making partner when I was an associate, and our client said, yeah, no, I did these things, and we listened to the presentation by the prosecution, and in those cases, the best thing a smart lawyer can do is seek a plea bargain, right? Is go in and negotiate and say, okay, you know, let's talk about, you know, what you want in these cases. And part of the reason for that is certainly in the federal court system, the sentencing guidelines are now advisory. We need to do an episode on the sentencing guidelines, but the way in which judges compute a sentence, one of the ways is, utilizing the sentencing guidelines, which is a matrix that just you get assigned a certain number based on the severity of the offense, and then the number moves up and down based on what you do. And one of the things you can do is you can cooperate early with the prosecutor. You can, you know, apologize. You can make restitution. All of these things will lower your number and thus lower your overall sentence. So, you know, so there are, I mean, the practical answer to the question. I mean, at first I was answering the, you know, the conscience question, right? Could you go in and represent a guilty client in court, knowing that he's guilty and arguing against the state? And yeah, like I think I don't have a problem with that. And I think most lawyers don't have a problem with that. B, on a practical level, you know, what do you do? And the practical level is you would very, if a client has come to you and said, you know, I did this, and you're now hamstrung in what you can do as a defense, a good lawyer is going to say that, right? He's going to say, hey, look, like, this is not a good case for us to try and go to trial and get a not guilty verdict. This is a good case where you've told me you've done it. Now let's tell the prosecutor you've done it.
Yeah.
And, okay, you know, let's plead this out. And 99% of cases plead out. So, yeah, you know, it diffuses the drama a little bit, but that's that.
All right. Well, yeah. Interesting questions. Thank you guys so much for that. I like that they kind of shared a common theme. That's cool. And now I suppose it's time for our co-favorite segment of the week, which is Top Patron Friday.
Top Patron Friday.
Hall of Famers. And they are Chrissy, offers job coaching at blueprintgreen.us. Use code OA17 and save. Wow, I like
nice.
That.
Good work, Chrissy.
Kaylee Reiser, Major Dennis Bloodnock, Commander 56 Heavy Underwater Artillery. Heather Leverage, Aaron Grady, Adam Lenda, Soggy Pants, Stephen Boyd at DJ Empirical, Sam Danow, Eli Bosnick, Teresa Gomez, Happy Birthday, Andrew, Happy Birthday, Sarah, Love Ashik's Sixth Sick. Okay, that wasn't as long as a tongue twister because of the birthday message. By the way, yes, happy birthday, Andrew. Sorry, I didn't lead off with that. I should have.
Well, thank you, Shake, and thank you, Thomas.
Manager of all our tentacles. Thank you, Ian and Ali. Dave, co-founder of the Florida chapter of Thomas's Goon Squad. Nichols. Jim Grove, Jeffrey Maynor, Keith Davies, Jaga, co-host of the Shifty Bastards Transformation Podcast. Malika Chandler, Jesse Stutt is my favorite lawyer. Andrew's a close two. POTUS supports jobless gay people. Wow, very apropos for this episode. Matthew Vernon, the law offices of the law offices of P parentheses urge Andrew Torres. The law offices of Purge Andrew Torres. Squick Thinger. CampQuest.org. 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 Tricicular Manslaughter and Philip Stromberg. Thank you, guys. Oh, I love this segment.
Oh, I don't know if I can beat that, but thank you to Philip Stromberg, the Wayward Willis podcast, Adopt a Homeless Pet and Oppose Declawing and Ear Docking, Dan, proud to be Thomas's goon, Irizarry, Rebecca Smelzer, Rhonda the Dork, Roger Metcalf and the Hired Goons. That definitely sounds like a...
Ooh, another band. Yeah, that's the opener for the Yodel Mountain Conspiracy.
Yeah. Agreed. Sammy, Seasick Sarah. I wonder if it was her birthday, if she's the Sarah that got the shout out. But Greg Sullivan, Torsten Peel of ponykilling.com dark humor game. So Torsten Peel plugging a whole bunch of his stuff. Good, you know, good use of the screen name. Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. And finally, thank you to the Grand Duke Niall. That's the actual name. He's
very clever.
Fool you. Violet Page Hall, Frederick Alstromer, Stop Breaking the Law, Asshole, Cody Bond. And Cody, we're going to hit your question on Tuesday. Defend University of Florida from Nazis and Racists, October 19th. Good message. Eric Johnson, Jessica Wilson, Mitchell, Reasonable Risk Podcast wants you to give to Ari Stillman on Patreon. Well, okay. Ari's a friend of ours. Michael Thomas's Chief Goon Rops, Lionel Hutz Esquire, Attorney at Law. Thank you, Lionel Hutz. Carl Zippel wishes Sargon had a different name. Yeah. Conrad Michaels and our top patron, Zabby. Thank you all so much. This and thank you for making this segment great. This has been fantastic.
It's the best.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, time for, boy, what used to be such an easy segment. Don't look now, but I think I'm on, what, like a four-question Losing streak? This is not good.
All right, Thomas. So, the owner of a state-licensed massage parlor sued the state for arbitrarily canceling its license and prior business permits to conduct a massage parlor at a given location in the city. Due to allegations of illegal activities in other massage parlors in the city, the owner's personal license and the business permits were revoked. The only procedure provided was a letter from the city declaring a new policy on massage parlors that had to be rapidly instituted for the welfare of the community. She, that's the owner, sued the city in federal court, claiming that her business had been taken without just compensation in violation of the Fifth Amendment's takings clause. Mm. She also claimed a lack of procedural due process under the 14th Amendment. The court granted a motion to dismiss based on her not having a property interest that was affected, including in the license and permits. She appealed the decision. Will the Federal Court of Appeals affirm the lower court's dismissal of her case?
Yikes.
Yep.
What a question.
So Fifth and 14th Amendment, is there a property interest in the license and the permits? So your answer choices are A, yes. That is, yes, the Federal Court of Appeals will affirm the lower court's dismissal, saying that she has no case, because there is no right to earn a living under the substantive due process clause. B, yes, because the state interest in protecting the public from illegal activities required that state action that was taken. C, no, because once the parlor had opened with all the proper permits, it could not be deprived of its licenses for any reason until they were up for renewal. Or D, no, because she had a property right in her license and permits, which were taken without any procedural due process.
All right. One thing about this question that's a little inside baseball for bar exam takers is I find it funny when there's something that should be so obvious it's on a bar exam question and yet the court went the other way in the question. I always love that. Like, I always want to know more background on like why the hell the court didn't know this very basic legal thing. But anyway,
that's we used to call that the law and order strategy in law school. Because I've said, you know, law and order where they do the gets thing, the law right.
Yeah.
But yeah, the way in which they would manufacture conflict is they would have a trial court ruling and then you would cut away to a scene in the DA's office.
Where they're just like, I can't believe they blew that. Right. That kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to eliminate. Here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I'm going to do for you guys. I'm going to eliminate B because if this bites me, I'm blaming Andrew. It's 100% Andrew's fault and he's taking the loss for this one. But for B, I think using our issue spotting, this really seems to be a question about the 5th, 14th Amendment, I guess both, and due process. And so if the answer B, which is yes, because the state interest in protecting the public from illegal activities required the state action was taken, I feel like that's just not the issue at stake here. It doesn't really make sense. Now, I could be wrong, but I'm going to eliminate that one because I think that's just one of those attractive distractors where it doesn't matter if there's a state interest, you still have to have due process. I think that's kind of beside the point. And then I'm also going to eliminate C, which is no, because the parlor had opened with all the proper permits. It could not be deprived of its licenses for any reason until they were up for renewal. Well, that seems wrong. I feel like you could lose your license for multiple reasons other than just they're not up for renewal. So that leaves us with A and D. Yes, because there's no right to earn a living under the substantive due process clause. Or D, no, because she had a property right in her license and permits, which were taken without any procedural due process. So that really seems to be the issue. I hope I've cut through to the proper legal issue, which is like, do these licenses and permits qualify as property in a sense where the government can't just take it away without due process? And I guess I'll have to answer with my heart and hope that it's true that they can't do that. And I'll go with D, no, because she had property right, which were taken without any procedural due process. I'll hope that that's the true answer. Who knows? I could be wrong, but I'm kind of hoping it's a basic question where where the straightforward answer is the correct one.
All right. Well, if you agree with Thomas's heart and want to pick D, let us know. If you maybe agree with Thomas's head and want to pick some other answer, let us know. No, I'm not trying to weigh in and influence our listeners. You know how to play along with Thomas Takes the Bar Exam. Get on Facebook or Twitter, quote or share out our announcement episode. Share this episode with your friends and include with it the hashtag TTTBE and your answer and reasons therefore, and we will pick a winner. It will go on Tuesday's show, and we will shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Never-ending fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
It's a tough one, but I hope I got back on the correct side of the ledger. Get back on,
all right,
because this is a bad streak. All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you so much for Andrewing. And of course, our patrons at patreon.com/law. Going to be another round of bonus stuff coming up here in a week or two. Can't wait for that. Thank you guys. And we will have to see you next week.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.